basically trying to let people know. So, you know, at 2:30 in the morning, I'm calling people, and in just a few short hours, I'm going to be getting a heart transplant.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Life, a podcast brought to you by LifePath. Donation can be a complicated subject, but it is really all about life. Spend a few minutes as we unravel the complexities of donation. Let's talk about life.
Life is an unpredictable journey that can change in an instant. When we contemplate the potential mishaps that can befall us, such as a heart attack, accident, fire, or flood, it's a small miracle that we can return safely home at the end of each day unscathed. Of course, we are fortunate to have brave individuals on the front lines to help us when these types of trauma occur. Policemen, firemen, doctors, and nurses. But what happens when trauma and tragedy happens to them? Hi, you're listening to episode 145 of Let's Talk About Life. I'm your host, Colleen Gerber, kidney recipient and LifeBank staff member. We are talking with Matthew Carey on this episode. Matthew was an EMT, firefighter, and fire chief of more than 20 years when his world changed forever. Matthew, thank you so much for talking with me and sharing your story.
Absolutely. Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
You are one of those frontline heroes who answered the call when people were in need. Can you share about your career as a firefighter and EMT with our listeners?
Sure. One of the things everybody asks all the time is, you know, why were you a fireman? And I have a more of a unique story. My dad was a fireman. Both my brothers are firemen currently. My sister is a firefighter in Kentucky. My reasoning for wanting to be a firefighter is I was a young kid. I probably would say 5 or 6 years old, getting ready for Thanksgiving dinner, and our oven stopped working. And I kid you not, my dad loaded everything up, told mom we'll go down to the firehouse, and he cooked the Thanksgiving dinner down there and brought it back. But I got to spend the night at the firehouse. So, wow. You know, 6 years old, being at the fire station, staying down there, the smells, the sights, hearing the radios going off all night. And that's what did it for me. Obviously, helping people, you know, those things. But I fell in love with the job because my dad had to cook the Thanksgiving dinner down there.
Isn't that awesome? What a memory. I love that.
Yeah.
So. That's wonderful. And talk about what you did as a firefighter and EMT. You must have seen so many different traumas. What was that like for you on a daily basis?
When I first started, I grew up in a smaller town, Central Ohio, in Mara County, Mount Gilead, Ohio. So as I did that, my dad was on the fire department there. He was also the local police chief there as a smaller fire department at the time. And the place started to grow a little bit more. And I got older, I became an EMT and then a paramedic and get on the fire department. And my first couple years on the job, I worked there. And then I worked for the city of Worthington, Columbus. So I worked multiple places. And at home, with it being a small area, the first few years of my career, I dealt with a lot of things. You know, I would go in car crashes, people I graduated high school with, classmates, parents. So it was a lot of small towns. So I dealt with a lot of people that I knew personally. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up down in the Cincinnati area. And I was down there 15 years, down along the Ohio River, a little bit faster paced area, a lot bigger. And we dealt with a lot of weird things. The river, very hilly, very get off the road. You're going to roll three times, ended up in a creek somewhere. One night, I can remember, we had a flood and a tornado both in the same night before. It's just, it was amazing. There was a lot of things that I saw. A lot of times, the things that would bother me or affect me is I would go on calls if I had kids about the same age. And for the longest time, you know, when you're young, you don't think anything's going to happen to you. But yeah, there was a lot of bad things. And I'll be honest with you, I retired. It's been a year ago now in January. And now that I'm retired and I have more time, I guess, to think about it, reflect, I realize it more. It wasn't as much of a thing until I retired.
Wow. Yeah. Now you have time, like you said, to reflect on it and understand. Yeah. And then the impact of how many people you've touched and you've helped. That's amazing. Right.
Yeah. And that came up when I'd gotten sick and got my transplant. Some of those people actually reached out to help me with things. So it was pretty amazing.
That is amazing. So you brought it up in 2020. You said you came down with what you thought was bronchitis, right?
Right.
Turned out to be something much more.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, the COVID thing had started up. We had just recently came back to the North Central Ohio area. So we had been down in the Cincinnati area for years. My kids wanted to be back up around family, cousins, things like that. I was already a fire chief down in Monroe Township. We came back up this way in 19. I took a job for Springfield Township Fire Department in Richland County. It's Ontario City, right beside Mansfield City. Fire chief here had retired. I took that job. And so about the end of November of 20, I started to feel kind of sick. I'd went to the hospital. They thought I had bronchitis, give me stuff to take care of that. You know, we thought it was COVID, of course. You know, everything was COVID, they thought at that point, but it wasn't. By December 26th, I hadn't gotten any better. So I went back, and then that's when they diagnosed me with stage 4 heart failure.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, quite quickly. It came out of nowhere.
You must have been shocked when you got that diagnosis.
Yeah. So basically, they had given me some information. You know, it's close to the holidays. You know, they're like, hey, go follow up with this cardiologist, blah, blah, blah. Being the fire chief and where I was at, I had our medical director, fortunately, unfortunately for him, because I could bother him all the time. So I spoke with him and we decided, we're like, hey, this is not good. I don't know that we can wait that long. So I basically 2 days later started my journey on this. I went to Ohio State University first. They had started the process with me, had sent me home.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're going into 21. So I was in the hospital at OSU January 6th, which was my birthday. I spent New Year's, my birthday, all that. Got out. I was only home, I would say, 3 days. And then I started having some complications. And the fire department that I worked at, they came and picked me up and took me to Cleveland Clinic.
Oh, wow.
Right. Yeah, we had done some research and looked at stuff and decided that was probably the best place to go. So they took me by squad right to the ER right there at Cleveland Clinic. And I was doing pretty bad at that point. That's when they looked, my ejection fraction was about 7. Cleveland Clinic's pretty amazing. You know, they're a pretty well-oiled machine. I can't complain on that at all. It's like anything and everything that happened with me, it was like just another day for them. No big deal. They managed everything pretty amazingly, actually.
You're right. They see it every day and they know exactly what to do. A very unique facility, I will say that.
Right. And I know there's all these different hospitals and different things are doing things, and that's all great. But the way Cleveland Clinic handled everything, you know, at one point I went into cardiogenic shock, and being a paramedic, and that was kind of a good thing and bad thing because I knew what was going on lot of the time. I'm like, well, I know what this is. I've seen cardiogenic shock. I've never actually been in it, obviously. So, but you know, my nurse, she realized it right away. And no big deal. Like, she's like, you're in cardiogenic shock. I'm like, yeah, I know. You know, they grabbed some stuff. They had a procedure room to do stuff right there on that floor. They went in, put a balloon pump in. So at that time, they had some different procedures. The balloon pump that they put in was something they did quite a bit. But later on, once I got stabilized, they went ahead and they took that out and put it in my armpit. And I guess that time frame, it was a procedure that's not done very often in many places.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. And so I had to have that in for a time till they could figure out exactly what direction they were going to go with things for me.
And it ended up, of course, with a heart transplant. And do you remember when they told you that a matching heart had been found?
Originally, they were going back and forth because, you know, they had to go through the testing, look at things, make sure things are going to work, make sure you're a good candidate. At one point, their game plan was, hey, let's put you on an LVAD. we'll send you home. We'll get you on the transplant list. At least you'll have some sort of decent living. Cause you know, at this point I'm basically laying on my back the entire time. I've got a balloon pump in me, you know, all mm-hmm. these machines hooked up. Quite honestly, the argument was if I have an LVAD, there's no way I'll be able to go back to work. I mean, now that I'm retired, I think that's crazy. But at the time, that's all I could think of is I wanted to go back to work.
Yeah.
So they basically said, hey, look, we'll make a deal. You know, we'll put you on the transplant list. We'll give you 14 days. If you don't get anything, then we'll put an LVAD in. And that's what we did. So to answer your question, do I remember? Yeah, I mean, it was on day 12. So February 7th of 21. Like 2 o'clock in the morning. And this is the thing, the nurses are all very versed in what's going on and they care about your life. And everybody knew stuff about me. And of course, I probably wasn't the best of patient because I was always yelling at them about putting IVs in and how to do it, you know. So they were pretty well versed with me anyways. But they came in and woke me up and said, hey, you have a phone call. And I'm like, okay. You're like, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning. I really don't know what's going on. And basically, it was just the doctor saying, hey, we found a really good match, we think. They told me it was a male. They had said that there was some possibility of some hepatitis, you know, because they had had some things in the past. And they'd already explained that situation to me that, you know, that's not a big deal. That's treatable now. And, you know, I was like, yeah, it don't matter to me. That's fine.
Yeah.
That was the biggest question they really had. And I'd heard on the floor previous that there were some other people. I'd heard just a few days before that someone had, and I don't remember what organ it was, but they had turned down an organ, you know, because of that possibility. And I'm like, I can't believe that. Like, this is treatable. They can take care of this. Like, that's the least of your problems, you know? So,
yeah.
But that was the biggest thing I remember is them asking, you know.
Well, it's considered an extended criteria donor.
Right.
So it's something that's outside
right.
of, you know, what they're looking for. So,
I figured at day 12, I wasn't going to look a gift horse in the mouth. So,
well, I know. Agree with you 100%. I would have said yes too, if I was in your,
shoes. And luckily, yeah. And luckily it never became an issue or a problem. So,
yeah.
But yeah, that was the biggest thing I can remember. And then just basically trying to let people know. So, you know, it, 2:30 in the morning, I'm calling people and, you know, in just a few short hours, I'm going to be getting a heart transplant. I mean, it was a pretty big whirlwind to begin with because, I mean, this happened. I mean, it was just months, like, you know, and December 26th, they're telling me I'm heart failure. And by the 7th of February, I'm getting a transplant.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was a lot.
Wow.
A lot to try to figure out. So
you said your donor was a young man. Do you know the age?
Yeah, they had told me at the time is 23.
Mm-hmm.
And months later, we researched and looked at things to try to see if we could come up with ideas. I did write stuff. We haven't heard anything back, but the person that we think it was, they had been involved in a vehicle crash. So I don't know. I mean, who knows? That might not be, but it just, some of the stuff matches up. Maybe it's not. I don't know.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. And, you know, it goes to show that it's a young, healthy heart and it's keeping you alive. So that's the main point, right?
Yeah. The worst part about this entire deal is this is going on during COVID. So, you know, I was in the hospital the entire time by myself. You know, family wasn't allowed in. The only interaction I had with my family was from the window. There was times they would come up to Cleveland Clinic and stand out in the parking lot and wave and we talk on the phone or hold up signs and things like that. I wasn't able to have any sort of contact with my family for almost 3 months. So, you know, I go to the hospital on December 28th, was in there till early January, was home for 4 days and back to the hospital again, you know, and I get out sometime in early March at that point. So 3-4 months, I'm in the hospital the entire time and didn't have anybody there. So that was a big thing. So the phones and, you know, video chat was a big thing. So they let me video chat all the way down and I was out. Next thing I remember waking up in the recovery, but the doctor told my wife that says it's one of the best ones. He said, basically, as soon as he dropped it in, it took off. So, and I've been lucky. I haven't had any real complications of any sort. And we're going on almost 3 years now.
Excellent. So. Excellent. So Matthew, we're going to turn the corner here. You had a successful transplant and life was going along and you were feeling much better, I presume.
Yeah. Right.
And then again, you had a tragedy strike your family. Do you want to share about your daughter, Abby?
Sure. My wife's a hospice nurse, Tanya. We've got three kids, Caitlin, who's 18 now, my son, Ryan, who's next in line, who's 17 now, and then my youngest daughter, Abby, who will be 15 forever as we go into this story. They had obviously at an early age and understood all this stuff. And, you know, organ donation became pretty important to all of them. And as my kids got their driver's license, they all, you know, had no problem with making sure they wanted to be organ donors. And Abby, even though she wasn't able at the time to get her driver's license or even her permit yet, because December 27th would have been her 15th birthday, she wanted a state ID so she could have the organ donor on there because she knew how important that was. And I get my transplant February. I come back. I actually went back to work in April of 21. And I worked all the way up till January of 23 when police and fire went ahead and medically retired me. I was on restrictions the whole time. It just was getting pretty hard. Plus, they had deemed my transplant to be work-related from smoke and heat inhalation is what that's what they could come up with. And my restrictions were pretty crazy, like stay away from fire and smoke. Don't be around sick people. I ended up with COVID multiple times in the hospital, things like that. So January 10th of 23, I retired. And the idea was, I thought, you know, we'd have, especially with our youngest, Abby, we'd have all this time. And on February 18th of 23, my son Ryan and Abby, they were actually going fishing. We had just recently put a pond in, and the two of them had came up with this idea. They wanted to stock the pond, and when they started to look how expensive it was to stock the pond, it was a lot of money. So they came up with the idea that they would just do it themselves. But they thought they would just go fishing and bring fish back. That was their thought process. So that's what they had done. So they had basically had just planned out the night before. And so they were going to Clear Fork Reservoir up by us. So they went up, of course, you know, they didn't catch anything, but so, you know, all the kids are pretty big fishing, doing all that stuff as normal. Ryan, coon hunts, and he's got a bird dog and turkey and deer hunts. And Abby, we had just got her hunting license. She just shot her first deer in December. So, you know, fishing, doing all that stuff as normal. And they were coming back and they didn't navigate a curve and the vehicle went off the road. They hit a culvert. It flipped over multiple times. Abby was ejected from the vehicle. She didn't have her seatbelt on. My son did. When the Jeep came to rest, he was still in it. She was not. The way she was thrown out of the vehicle when the Jeep came back down, the Jeep actually landed on her, basically right on her neck is where it landed at, face down. So I wasn't in the area, but this actually had occurred in the fire district where I had just retired. So I still get the notifications to my phone. So Ryan, my son, had called 911, and then he calls his mom, and he's obviously distraught going through things. And then she gets off the phone and calls me. About that time, I'm getting the notification from the 911 center of this accident. So I'm telling her where it's at, but right in the call note, it's talking about how the person's pulseless, not breathing, all that, and I'm not telling her this. But, you know, we're having a discussion. She's going there. So my wife beat the fire department there.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah. So she's there. And like I said, she's a nurse. She goes up and Abby's pulseless and apneic. And she says on the phone, you know, Abby's dead. And so I'm like, you know, let's see what's going on. So I had gotten off the phone with her and I'd called the assistant chief. I had went up north with a friend. I mean, I never go anywhere. And so I was a little ways away. So I explained to him what's going on, who it was. He's like, okay, because he's on his way there. So they get there. I called my brothers to say, hey, look, you guys need to, if you can, come there, go there. It's going to take me a while to get there. So they had to use airbags to pick the vehicle up to get her out from underneath of it.
She was in cardiac arrest. They did start working her. They did actually get her back at that point. They put her in the medic. And so we don't have a level one or level two trauma center by any means, but the closest trauma center here is Mansfield. Mm-hmm. So they went there first. And while they were there, other family got there. My wife was there. You know, Ryan had some injuries and stuff, but he wasn't that beat up or anything, obviously, because he had a seatbelt on. And so by the time I get there, they're dealing with him, and she was in the trauma room. So I went to the trauma room. She had coded again a second time when she got to the ER, and they had gotten her back again. When I was in the ER, I was looking at stuff. I was looking at her blood pressure. I was looking at her respirations, all that, knowing that it meant one or two things. Her stuff was somewhat stable, and it was either because A, she was back, or B, it was from the medication. And that's what I'm waiting to see. It came apparent that she had some internal bleeding. She started to have some issues with maintaining her blood pressure, things like that. The whole plan was to transport her to Children's in Columbus, no matter what.
Yes.
But she didn't stay stable enough at Mansfield to do so. So they came up with a plan. Hey, we're going to take her in. We're going to fix this internal bleeding. We're going to roll her out of there right to the waiting helicopter and go to Children's. And that's what they did.
Oh my God.
And so that was February 18th. We go to Children's. She fought a good fight, for a couple of days. Then amazingly enough, she didn't have any injuries to any of her extremities or anything like that. I mean, it was all from the neck up, and obviously the cardiac arrest both times that she had caused a lot of issues too. Lack of oxygen to the brain, things like that. Well, they started to have issues where they were having a hard time controlling the swelling of her brain.
Mm.
And the decision had been made, well, hey, we're going to look at maybe trying to basically drill a hole in her head to give her brain somewhere to go. And when they went in to do the scan, that's when they started to realize that it didn't look good. So
brain function.
Well, you could tell from the scans the differences in the brain. You know, you could see the dead tissue. You could tell the difference. You could just see it on the scans from, 3 days previous to then.
Mm-hmm.
With all the swelling, other stuff, she was having seizures, stuff like that. All stuff that's, common with a brain injury.
Yeah.
Common with, lack of oxygen, all that kind of stuff. Once again, things that, I'm understanding what's going on. I'm understanding where things are, and it's like, it's one of those deals where it sucks. It doesn't. At least you have an idea, but it's not great when it's your kid, obviously.
Oh, obviously. Yeah. Yeah.
So the way that it's set up there, they do brain function testing to be able to declare somebody, clinically brain dead. They have to do it. They do it twice, and they do it within a 12-hour period. Different teams do it, basically just to make sure things are done. Right, and you get every chance that you can get, and that's what they did. And she obviously, there was nothing. There was nothing at all. We had determined early on, before the second one they did on the 25th, in the morning of the 25th, that she'd want to do organ donation.
Mm-hmm.
So we had already started that process. They came in and started having conversations, and we were like, "Look, we already know. We get all this. Give us the paperwork. Yeah, we're signing it. Let's get this going." They said it was a unique situation because of her injuries. They were so right to her neck was the thing. She had broken bones. She didn't have any of that kind of stuff. So basically, they were able to take her into surgery on the 26th, and she was able to donate. And we had gotten a letter later on, and so they'd taken her right kidney, her left kidney, her liver, and her lungs were donated to people that needed stuff. Right away.
Wow.
There was stuff for research, like her pancreas, bones, long bones, soft tissue. Her ribs went to research for vehicle strains for kids, to better try to do some stuff with that. Eyes or
corneas,
Corneas, yes. Those went to two people out in California, I guess. There was people in Michigan, Indiana got stuff. So, we got a little bit of an update, ages, things like that. The kidneys and liver and everything, and went to people been on the list for over a year. I couldn't imagine. I was on for 12 days. I couldn't imagine sitting around waiting for something for over a year.
How ironic that you were on that waiting list and somebody saved you and now your daughter is saving others.
Right. Yeah.
Obviously, there's no words to talk about losing a child, especially if, you know, your youngest and just the potential, the loss of a beautiful life.
Yeah.
But you and your wife have decided to honor Abby with Abby's Echo. Do you want to share what Abby's Echo is all about?
We started a nonprofit. So what I did, we had our celebration life on March 11th, and it helped with me. I just dove right in, and we got this nonprofit going and started up Abby's Echo. We have a website, Facebook stuff. But basically, the thought process is organ donation and seatbelts. And where we got the name, you know, we kicked around a billion different things trying to figure it out. And Abby had just started getting into coon hunting. We have a dog. So my son had dogs. We had just gotten Abby her own dog. And the dog's name is Echo. And she had just started doing bench shows and was doing a little bit of competition hunting. And Brian, just out of the blue, he got the paperwork and changed Abby's dog's name to Abby's Echo. And so that's where we went with it. And so we have Echo still today. She hunts. Ryan hunts her. She's doing really well. But that was Abby's dog. But also, we felt Abby's Echo was fitting because, you know, she's not here anymore. But, you know, this is kind of a way to spread the word of organ donation and seatbelts. And so some of the things that we've done is going to some safety days and talking. We had looked at the local school. I talked to the police chief here. And we found out that they do a lot of things in the schools, but going in and talking about making sure you wear your seatbelt's not one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be a little bit morbid for some of these high school kids to talk about organ donation, but it's important to at least have something on the radar for them to look at and try to make a decision for themselves.
Well, and you're absolutely right. When you think about it, they're going to be asked that question when they get their first driver's license.
Right.
So better to be educated and make that decision than not. So,
yeah, there's a lot of fallacies out there on how that works, you know, or the thought processes to it. So, you know, I mean, we're talking about a 15-year-old girl that understood it. So they should have some understanding, too.
And, right.
You know, just let them go out and get the information. But the seatbelt thing's a big thing. I mean, you know, if nothing else, you know, just wearing the seatbelt. I mean, and not just in my daughter's case, but I mean, just in my 20 years in my career, I can't tell you how many times a seatbelt has saved lives or could have saved a life. Mm-hmm. And ironically enough, Abby was my worst one. She just did not like to wear seatbelts. And I would yell at her quite often about, you know, doing it. And it's just one of those things. On the 25th, when I put out there, when it was her first year, I said, listen, you know, if nothing else, just wear your seatbelt for Abby. And I said that to people. She would have her seatbelt on. There's no doubt in my mind she'd still be here today. It's that simple. Just wear your darn seatbelt.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is we've talked about some of the driver's ed classes. I know an individual that has a driver's ed class here in Mansfield. You know, I plan on doing that now. And then, you know, any kind of podcast things or stuff like that. But the biggest thing is the social media and just trying to do different stuff like that. Lifeline had a walk this past summer, so we did that. And, you know, we had signs for me and for Abby, obviously, recipient and donor, because my family all did that. It's really a way to keep her memory alive. The thing I worry about is, so I had a call, it's been almost 17, 18 years ago now, a young lady, they were hit and she was killed by a drunk driver.
Uh-huh.
Long story short, we would drive by this area. There had always been for years and years, there was always memorials out there for her. And I just noticed in the past year, I went by there and there's nothing there anymore. And that breaks my heart. I don't want that for my daughter. And so that's why doing this, I'm hoping by having this nonprofit, you know, when I'm gone, when my wife, anybody, you know, I'm hoping in some way, some form, this thing's going to stay forward and thing. Someone's going to have something there, some sort of thing together that is not going to go away. You know, this monument that alongside the road is not going to just basically be gone. And and that really bothered me. But, you know, time goes on. You know, I don't know what all has happened, but I think in some, I'm sure she's not forgotten, but that just, it just bothered me.
And that's the beauty of organ donation is that, right, you know, you're leaving a legacy of life.
As time goes on, I don't want not just Abby to be forgotten, but the fact of like seatbelts and organ donation to be forgotten. Because like I said, you know, when I got sick, one of the things that really got to me is there was a lot of things that the community did for me to try to raise money, GoFundMe, sell stuff. There was people that I had dealt with throughout my life. There was one lady, her husband called my family and said, hey, we just donated. I just wanted you to know, I've never met your husband, but he saved my wife's life, and we just felt like it was needed. And that happened several times where people had done stuff for me when I was sick. And then when Abby's stuff happened, people just came out of the woodwork.
It's always amazing. People are generally good. You know, it's unfortunately, you see it when a tragedy occurs. But I really believe that people have good hearts and they really want to help when they can.
Right.
What a demonstration of what a lovely daughter you had. Oh, my God.
Right.
Matt, is there anything you want to add that I didn't ask you or you want to make sure you share?
Obviously, yeah. I mean, if I've already said it 15 times, I'll say it the 16th time, you know, wear your seatbelt. You know, everybody's got their reason why, you know, this accident that my kids were in, they weren't far from home. You know, I'm just going down to the neighbors. I'm doing this. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, there was nobody else involved. They had a mechanical function in the vehicle and they went off the road. Where's your seatbelt? It doesn't matter. You know,
yeah.
They were, you know, probably 2 miles or less from home when this happened. So wear your seatbelt. And if I can, like, to get the word out, you know, so abbyzecho.org, you know, the website, www.abbyzecho.org. It's ABBIFECHO.org. You can find our Facebook from there, all that kind of stuff. We don't want anything but people just to follow and see and spread the message. Wear your seatbelt, organ donation. That's it. That's what we want.
Well, we couldn't agree with you more, Matthew, and we thank you so much for sharing your very unique story with us. And we wish you all the best in the future, and we hope you stay in contact with us and, you know, let us know how we can help you in on your mission with seatbelts and organ donation. So thanks, Matt.
Absolutely. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Let's Talk About Life. If you have questions about today's podcast, reach out to us at info@lifebank.org. Take a few minutes to do something heroic and register to be an organ donor by saying yes at lifebank.org. Literally, someone's life is depending on it.